This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our guest, actor Bradley Cooper, became widely known to film audiences last year with the release of The Hangover. He starred with Ed Helms and Zach Galifianakis as a crude, wisecracking guy whose trip to Vegas with his buddies for a bachelor party goes very wrong. Before that, he played the contemptible fiancé of Rachel McAdams' character in Wedding Crashers. And earlier this year, he got his shot at a leading role in Limitless, where he played a struggling writer who takes a drug that dramatically expands his brain power. Though Cooper's acquired an image as a Hollywood hunk, he's an honors graduate in English from Georgetown who didn't get into acting until after college when he attended the Actors Studio in New York. He grew up in a suburb of Philadelphia, and when he showed up at our studio, he brought along his mom. Cooper has reunited with most of the original cast of The Hangover for The Hangover Part 2, where another crazy bachelor's weekend unfolds, this time in Thailand. Bradley Cooper spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Bradley Cooper, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
The heart of this, of course, is the relationship between you and Ed Helms and Zach Galifianakis. And I thought we'd listen to a scene from The Hangover. That's the first one.
Great.
And this is a moment when you've just gotten into Vegas for what will be a bachelor party a couple of days. And you're there in the room with Stu, Ed Helms' character, who has this domineering girlfriend that your character, Phil, absolutely can't stand.
Mm-hmm.
And Stu announces to the group that he pulls out a ring and says he's going to propose. And Doug, the groom, Justin Bartha, is there. And at the end, we'll hear Zach Galifianakis' character, Alan, come in. Let's listen.
What the hell is that?
What do you think it is?
Oh, wow.
Well, if it's what I think it is, I think it's a big mistake.
I'm going to propose to Melissa at your wedding, after the ceremony.
Stewie, congratulations.
Thank you, Doug.
That's a beautiful ring.
Yeah, it's my grandmother. She made it all the way through the Holocaust with that thing. It's legit.
I don't get it. Wait, have you not listened to anything I've ever said?
Phil, we've been dating for 3 years. It's time. This is how it works.
A, that is and B, she is a complete
Hey, that's his fiancée.
It's true. It's true. You know it's true. She beats him.
That was twice, and I was out of line. She's strong-willed, and I respect that.
Wow. Wow. He's in denial. Not to mention she a sailor.
Hey, he wasn't a sailor. He was a bartender on a cruise ship. You know that.
Guys, just... I'm standing right here so I can hear everything that you're saying.
Hey, guys. You ready to let the dogs out?
What?
Do what? Let the dogs out. You know, like, who let the dogs out? Who?
Who brought this guy along?
Yes. Alan, we are ready to let the dogs out. Hey, congrats.
Thank you.
Who let the dogs out?
And that's from The Hangover.
It plays well as a radio play.
It does, doesn't it? our guest Bradley Cooper, along with Ed Helms and Justin Bartha and Zach Galifianakis in The Hangover. Now, your character is a guy who's crude, self-confident, outgoing. He's the sort of leader. He's the guy, if he found a rattlesnake in his cornflakes, would say, guys, we'll work with this. That's not like you, huh?
I wouldn't be so bold to say that I'm as at ease with myself in life as Phil is. Phil just has this sort of hermeneutic that causes him no stress. He really just knows what is and what isn't. And with that comes a tremendous amount of confidence and ease. And you could question his ethics. You know, he has an interesting moral compass. But the things that I love Phil, and I think he's the coolest guy, I'd say, besides wanting to have fun and complain about his life, he will do anything for his friends. And that's clear, you know, that especially in the second one. I mean, he just stays cool and has to try to figure a way out through the whole movie. And the wonderful thing about the first one is, as crude as it was, if you boil the story down, these three guys just don't want a girl to miss her wedding day. That's it. You know, so it's a very forgivable. There's sort of a very childlike, boyish quality to what these guys are doing. But it's so surrounded and peppered with these very sort of morose, lurid incidents.
Right, but at the
crux, they just don't want a girl to miss her wedding day.
Now, when Ed Helms was on the show, it was interesting to hear that, you know, one of the things in the Hangover is that Mike Tyson's tiger is in the bathroom, the hotel bathroom when you wake up. And you actually do have to work with a live tiger.
Right.
And it's Ed that goes in and delivers the the meat to the tiger in the bathroom.
That's
to
right.
Drug him. You didn't have to deal with the tiger?
No, we all had to deal with the tiger. In fact, I think I had the riskiest move. One of the stills that never made it into the end of the movie was the tiger at the party the night before, hanging out with everybody. So we shot these stills, and there was one still where they wanted somebody to feed the tiger. And I, for some reason, said I'd do it. And so I had – it was a baby's – you know, a binky with a bottle, and it was chicken blood. And I was literally putting it – and the trainer said to me, now, in order to feed a tiger, you have to press your hand up against its mouth, because if you don't, it won't know where your hand is, and it'll try to bite it. So if you at all loosen up on the tension with pressing against its mouth, it's going to do that. So it's this weird sort of illogical move that you do, that you're actually pushing into the tiger's snout, I guess, whatever you would call it, your nose and teeth, while it's sucking on this binky. I was terrified. But I was petting it. I got to pet it, actually, as I did that, which was kind of cool to actually really feel. It was a female. She was 15 years old. Now, she was pretty tame. I mean, that said, let's qualify it. Not tame at all. She's a tiger. But there were two younger tigers whenever she would get tired or something, and they were just completely out of control. I could have never done that to those tigers.
Now, the animal in the Hangover Part 2 is a monkey.
Yeah. Oh, God, love her. Crystal, who I worked with 6 years prior in a movie called Failure to Launch, if you can believe that. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Crystal.
Reunited with a
reunited
monkey.
Reunited with Crystal, who's, God, she's gotten better.
But no mishaps with the monkey, no scratches, bites.
I got tons of scratches. I mean, as you could tell, Phil and the drug-dealing monkey become quite close physically throughout the movie. And we sort of like this idea of, like, for some reason it just gravitates towards Phil, yeah. And Alan loves the monkey and loves Phil, so it's this weird thing.
Right. Phil, your character.
Phil, my character. Yeah, the character I play.
Right.
And there was this one scene where we were in the streets of Bangkok and there was an elephant as an extra in the background. Now, a monkey and an elephant, you know, hopefully the two will never meet, because every time that elephant came within 10 to 15 feet, Crystal would just claw into my shoulder.
Oh.
I mean, I was like bleeding, and I had scars probably the whole time I was doing the movie, and we kept saying, she has her shots, right?
Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty intense.
Our guest is Bradley Cooper. He stars in the new film, The Hangover Part 2. So you grew up in a Philly suburb, and I think a lot of people who see you in The Hangover and some of your other roles would assume that you were the most popular guy at school, charming, self-assured. Was that you?
No. My mother would beg to disagree, but not at all. In fact, quite the opposite. You know, look, I had great parents and a wonderful upbringing, but like many adolescents, was stuck in my head for most of that period of time, worrying about who, you know, if I'm cool, what I'm supposed to be like, how I'm supposed to sound, what is it to be a man, what's happening in my body, you know, girls, mind-altering substances, all that kind of stuff, how to escape basically in order to feel better. You know, never really feeling like I fit into a group, a clique. Very empathetic as a kid throughout my whole life, which has really been a wonderful asset. But it's tough when you're so empathetic, sort of living in a high school environment.
Yeah, that's not a high school male trait that's
no,
valued particularly.
Not really.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, you went to you did a year of college at Villanova, which is in the Philly area, and then went to Georgetown.
That's right.
Finished there, got a degree in English.
That's
and I
right.
read that you did no drama there. You didn't want to be in front of an audience?
Well, I've always was scared, as you can tell by the way I described my mental state in high school. The idea of being in front of people terrified me. That said, I always knew I wanted to be an actor, so in there lies a huge dilemma.
Yeah.
I remember I did senior skits. That was one thing I did in high school, the only thing. And then when I got to college, you couldn't even minor in theater at Georgetown. There was no theater program. There were two theater troupes, the Nomadic Theater Company and then another theater company called the Mask and Bauble. I also didn't feel at all comfortable with the theater crowd as I saw it when I was in high school. I never felt any connection to those students. And so too was it true in Georgetown.
Why?
I don't know. I felt like I just had nothing in common with them. Maybe I was intimidated by them. They seemed very theatrical. I was a lover of film. Film is what was my avenue into acting. So I didn't even know anything about theater. It was much more theater oriented. But then there was this group called the Nomadic Theater Troupe that I kind of felt like, okay, I can jive with these guys. So I auditioned for some plays, and I played Azalon, the servant, and Dangerous Liaisons was the first thing I'd done. And then Camino Real, the play by Tennessee Williams, I played Casanova.
you applied to the actor school at the new
Yeah, the Actor Studio the MFA Studio program, at, yeah, which is yeah. now at Pace University but was at the new school when I applied.
Right, and this is the one that people know from the public TV
That's right,
shows
yeah.
with James
Lipton.
Lipton,
yeah.
right, right, right. And I read that to do the audition to get in, you got a professor from
Georgetown priest, yeah.
To drive up to New York and do
a Carmelite priest named Andrew Skotnicki. Who I had had three courses with and became a great friend of mine. But, you know, a prerequisite was that you'd have to pass this audition-like scene. So I asked Andrew if he said, what if we do the scene from Mass Appeal where he plays a Monsignor, a drunk Monsignor who hits his deacon and it's a great scene. And so he and I took a train from D.C. to New York and walked down to the new school on 12th and 6th Avenue. And then we auditioned. And then we went to the Triple Crown bar, drank our butts off, and then got in the train and came back. And it was great.
And you got in.
And I got in.
And after you had some success in your career, you went back and did a guest appearance with James Lipton in the Actor's Studio.
That's right, yeah.
And I've watched that. And it's a very emotional reunion for you.
Yeah, it really was.
And what was interesting that you said that your teacher there, Elizabeth Camp, I mm-hmm. believe, you had trouble getting the words out, but I believe you said that in her class was the first time you ever felt comfortable.
Yeah, she taught me how to relax. Yeah, that's true. She's incredible. And I was so happy to be able to, for people to even hear that, people in the audience, and for you to even hear that, because she's really an incredible teacher. And she was my basic technique teacher. It was a 3-year program. And that year was all about using what has happened in your life as tools to enter into an imaginary circumstance and play an imaginary character. And I thought, oh, you mean like all these insecurities that I have, all of these things that I thought are things I have to hide are actually ammunition. They're actually, nutrition for this work. It was mind-blowing.
So you actually got your first movie role, I think, while you were still in school, Wet Hot American Summer, where you
right.
played a gay camp counselor and you had a sex scene with Michael Ian Black.
Yeah.
And you got a lot of TV work and you've kind of developed your craft. You had a recurring role on Alias opposite Jennifer.
I was actually a series regular on that.
Yeah,
yeah, I shot the pilot, and that was a huge break. That was basically where I was sort of piecemealing checks together from jobs to, wow, you can actually maybe put down a mortgage on a small house, and you know you're making a paycheck every week, and you know you're going to make 22 episodes, and it was like, wow, I can actually make a living as an actor. It was pretty incredible. I could pay off my student loans.
And then comes Wedding Crashers, 2005, and your character is the obnoxious fiancé of Rachel McAdams, the guy that Owen Wilson hopes to woo in the film. Your guy's character's name is Sack Lodge. He is such a jerk. And we're going to listen to a little piece of the film. This is a moment where your character, Sack Lodge, has actually – he's sick in the bathroom because the Owen Wilson character has slipped something into his drink. And Rachel McAdams comes upon him bent over the toilet. Let's listen.
Oh, no. Are you okay?
Well, Claire, my head's buried in a toilet.
What do you think? Why don't you do the math, okay?
Honey, it's okay to be vulnerable sometimes. It's just me.
Yeah, you could just cut that cycle bell that your mom tells you, okay?
Right.
Hey, you want to help me out? Do you? Do you, kid? Why don't you go get me a 7-Up, okay? All right, because I think I might get vulnerable again.
And that's our guest Bradley Cooper from Wedding Crashers.
What
being
a
quite
jerk.
The jerk. Yeah, what a jerk.
Oh, my God. Wow.
Well, you know,
it's so great. I mean, she's just trying to help him. It's so psychotic. There's nothing malicious at all.
Right. And that demonic cackle that you have there. right. I mean this as a compliment when I say that. When I saw you in The Hangover, at some point somebody said, yeah, he was the guy in The Wedding Crashers. And I thought, really? Because and you look pretty much the same. I mean, you don't have like a big beard or anything, but they are such completely different human beings.
I mean,
this jerk in Wedding Crashers. Where did you get this character? Was he anybody you knew? Or?
He was definitely a composite of about 3 or 4 guys that I went to high school with, I think, without naming names. And the thing about these types of guys, for me, I was completely infatuated with them in the sense that how they go about living their life, so seemingly carefree, and they're so despicable, yet people gravitate towards them. and women like them. Yet they're so demeaning towards women. And I find myself fascinated by them. I just always – it was just a weird quandary about this type of man. And so I studied them in high school. And by the way, and it was also my idea of who they are. I mean, of course, they're much more complicated. But definitely having spent so much time observing these guys in high school, wanting to be them in many ways – it was very easy to inhabit that role. And by the way, very therapeutic.
Oh, really? In what way?
It's almost like, wearing the skin that sort of plagued you for so many years, you know?
Yeah. And knowing it ain't all that good, right?
That's true. You know what? Yeah, that is true.
Well, after The Hangover, which was just this phenomenal success, you did Limitless. Well, you did some other stuff too, but Limitless was a film where you really carried it. I mean, you are the lead. The premise is there's this struggling writer in New York, that's you, Eddie, and from a former drug dealer, he finds this drug that will allow him to essentially use the full capacity of his brain, remember everything he's ever heard, analyze situations with laser-like intensity. Let's listen to a scene. I mean, this is a scene kind of early in the film when you've just taken this drug. It mixes voiceover and dialogue because the film is taught is sort of told from your perspective. So we hear you describing what's happening, and then we hear you in a scene. In this particular scene, you've just taken this drug. It's kicking in, and you're discovering these amazing mental powers, and you have this hallway encounter with your landlord's wife, and you happen to notice in her bag that she's carrying a book from a law school course. Let's listen.
Something wrong in law school?
How do you know I'm in law school?
People who aren't usually don't carry around dry, academically constipated books about a dead Supreme Court justice.
You're a creep, aren't you?
No, I just noticed the book.
You just saw the corner of it. How did you know that?
I'd seen it before, 12 years ago in college.
If you're writing a paper, that's not the book I'd use.
Well, who asked you?
Hastings has his oral history. I'd start there. Interesting point. Grammatically, this guy was an idiot, which sort of gives credence to the theory that one of the clerks he had fired actually wrote most of this guy's major opinions. You could Google the clerk's sons. They'd love to talk to you, exonerate their dad. That'd give you something that no one else has.
Information from the odd museum show, a half-read article, some PBS documentary, was all bubbling up in my frontal lobes, mixing itself together into a sparkling cocktail of useful information. She didn't have a chance.
What are your suggestions?
And that's my guest, Bradley Cooper, with the actress T.V. Carpio from the film Limitless. Making a movie is such a weird process, I'm sure, in that, you know, you inhabit the character, you do your best. But so much of what actually happens after that, and even during it, you have little control over. You don't control the camera angles or the cinematography or how it's edited or then how it gets promoted afterwards. And when you did Limitless, I mean, in some respects, this was like a big opportunity for you to really carry a film.
Yeah.
Did it feel like a risk? Did you worry about that?
Not when I was filming it. It wasn't until Relativity started to re-envision the movie as a potential really box office earner.
And that's the production company.
That's right? The studio that made the movie. Studio, and right. I thought – because I always sort of saw it as this R-rated – I'd never been to a film festival. And I thought, oh, Dark Fields would be a movie I'd be able to take to a film festival, which would be a great experience. And then it was like, no. This is going to be a 2,500 theater release minimum. And we're going to try to – you know, this is – we're going to put this out there and put some money behind it. And then I thought, oh, wow, this is actually a shot. Meaning, you know, you get a couple shots up at the swings at bat after you're part of a big hit like The Hangover. And if it doesn't work, you know, because it's a transition. It's a transition as to be going from an ensemble work to a guy who's, you know, you're carrying the burden of a narrative on your shoulders. So I was trepidatious leading up to it, promoting the movie. You know, I still remember that Friday getting on a plane headed to L.A., talking to Tucker Tooley, who runs Relativity Media. And he said, look, it's going to be a four-horse race that weekend with Lincoln Lawyer and Paul and Limitless and then Battle L.A. in the second weekend, and we may come in fourth. And I thought, well, that's it. I really did. And I remember – and then 4 hours into the plane ride, the Wi-Fi was working, and all of a sudden the things changed. And they said, you know what? It looks like we're going to take the weekend and we may make 18, 19 million that weekend, which was just so absurd. If we made 40 for the run, 40 million, that would be, you know, a hit. That would be okay. But we made, you know, it's up to 77 million domestic and 140 something worldwide. I mean, it's so far exceeded anything we could have even dreamed. So that was just, you know, I was just over the moon about that.
So how's it affected your career? Do you even have to audition anymore now?
Oh, God. It's so funny to say that because this is why the business is just the greatest in an awful way. So Monday comes around and it won the weekend. And this is the thing. It's like if you can headline a movie and it wins the weekend, I mean, that's huge. And I'm talking to Dave, my agent. I said, buddy, this is it. I said, what do we got? What do we got today? And he goes, oh, man, let's see. Well, nothing yet. And then 4 p.m. rolls around, and I call him, Dave, hey, what do we got, guy? What do we got? This is fun. This is nothing. And it literally nothing changed. And I thought, it was just so funny. And, you know, just not that much changed at all. I just tried to get this other movie, and, you know, I begged the director to let me audition, and I just put myself on movie in my kitchen last week with my buddy Wes, literally in the kitchen doing two scenes, sending it to a director. So, you know, it's funny.
You videotaped an audition scene in your kitchen with a friend?
Yeah, with the flip camera, and then we emailed it to the director.
This is not how I pictured your life.
I know. It's great. But luckily, I love acting so much that I'll do anything if I feel a connection to a role. So that hopefully that'll never change.
Well, one thing that I know has to have changed in your life is just your visibility. I
mean, yeah.
I don't read a lot of celebrity stuff, but my daughter assures me that if I did, I would see you plenty. That there's a lot of stuff about you and people that you date, and you know, I'm picturing you working for 10 years as an actor, trying to get better, doing stuff, and now you're still that guy. You're still working as an actor, and suddenly people really care about every detail about your life, and paparazzi want to get your picture.
Right?
Do you have any kind of rules or guidelines you've set for yourself on definitely. How to deal with all that?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely have one rule that I've adhered to, and if you can get through 50 minutes of Howard Stern without doing it, you know that that you're solid. I just don't talk about my personal life in terms of relationships. I just won't ever talk about it. Well, first of all, in a broad sense, ideally, I don't want to know too much about the actors I love, because then I'm going to have to somehow deflect all of that when I'm watching them perform, because I want to see what they're doing. I love that I hear that Daniel Day-Lewis, you know, worked as a shoemaker, but I don't really know about Rebecca Miller and his two kids. I mean, I do because I'm saying it, but, you know, but I don't really know about him. I don't want to know about him too much because I want to see Bill the Butcher. You know, I want to see Daniel Plainview. I want to sink my teeth into what he's doing. So ideally, you know, I wouldn't want anybody to know anything about me. But here's the dilemma. I'm sitting here talking to you because you have to promote a movie. So it's this weird thing that you do, that I do in that way, because I want to promote a movie that I'm doing. That said, you know, two things that I've had to deal with. The paparazzi, the first month, I'd say, after The Hangover, my instinct was to go after them physically because it's a very intrusive thing. And then you realize that's exactly what they want. And now it's effortless. It is a part. It won't be there forever. It'll go away. And I feel pretty at ease with the paparazzi. But then the tabloid stuff is tough, you know, because it's incredible that they actually fabricate huge stories. And look, that said, they've aligned me with some wonderful women. So, you know, they've done well by me in terms of what they fabricated.
Accurately and inaccurately.
What I'm saying. You know, but you know, I should be so lucky. But it's just it's incredible that they just literally make up stuff. And unfortunately, you know, people that are close to you that didn't ask for this get wound up. Like my mother, for example, you know, has to deal with it. And people that are just my friends have to deal with it sometimes. But that all said, look, I mean, I get a chance to work with Robert De Niro. I get a chance to sit here with you today, you know, on a show that I've loved since I was an adolescent. That's nothing compared to this.
I read that you said once how brutal the business can be and that you've just tried to focus on getting better. What kind of feedback did you get in the early years on your auditions?
I've gotten everything back. You know, I've gotten that he's not effable. You can insert the word, you know.
Really?
Yeah. There was a movie called My Little Eye, and I still remember it, which was so odd because I wound up getting this role where the guy does come in and has sex with a woman. But I remember auditioning for it, and that was the feedback. And I was at the Sundance Film Festival with Wet Hot American Summer trying to get into the movie, and I couldn't even get into the movie I was in. And I remember talking to my agent at the time. She said, do you want to know the truth? I said, yeah. She goes, here's what they said. And she said that, and I thought, man, this business sucks. This is just the worst. But, you know, I've always you hear everything. And then certainly if you don't hear it, you can at any time hop on the internet and hear whatever your biggest fear is of all.
Well, Bradley Cooper, it's been fun. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you. It's a real honor to be on the show.
Bradley Cooper spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. He's reunited with Ed Helms and Zach Galifianakis in the new movie The Hangover Part 2. Coming up, our critic-at-large John Powers tells us about the prize-winning films at the Cannes Film Festival. This is Fresh Air. Some of the best films that just debuted at the Cannes Film Festival will be headed to American theaters in the near future, I hope. Our critic-at-large John Powers, who is also a film critic for Vogue, attended the festival, as he does most years, so we asked him to tell us about the films that won the top awards. Cannes is the world's most important international film festival, and many great films from around the world are first screened there. Why don't we start with the film that won the top prize at Cannes, The Tree of Life, which was directed by Terrence Malick. Although it won, it sounds like it really divided the audiences. What's it about?
It's a story at the center of which is the story about a young boy who would grow up to be Sean Penn later. Growing up in 50s Texas, his parents are played by Brad Pitt and Jessica Chastain. About 90 minutes of the movie is the story of this kid's life growing up during his young years in Texas. What makes the film strange is it's surrounded by two other things. On the one hand, there's a sort of 2001-ish version of the creation of the world, which I think is designed to parallel the creation of the one person's life. But that comes complete with the creation of the planet and with dinosaurs and all the rest, which is kind of odd for a film about Texas in the 1950s. And then the film actually then builds to yet another non-narrative thing, this kind of a dreamy, searcher, almost New Agey sequence, where Sean Penn, dressed in a business suit, walks across Death Valley, and maybe, or maybe not, I'm not clear from the film exactly, whether he winds up in heaven meeting all the people he'd known before. So what you have is a rather poetic and beautiful, normal story of a family in Texas surrounded by stuff that some people thought visionary and other people thought kitsch.
Where did you stand?
Well, I actually liked the creation of the world, complete with the dinosaurs, but I didn't like the New Age stuff of walking across the desert in the business suit, which I did think tended toward kitsch. What I loved was the middle section about the family, which almost as a standalone film would have been a great film. Now, I have to admit to a certain sentimentality about this because I grew up in the 50s in a town very much like this with a family dynamic that was very much like the family dynamic in the film. So on the one hand, it clearly touched me because it was personal. On the other hand, I'm struck by how accurate and poetically accurate that evocation of that period and that place and that world really is.
It sounds like this kind of almost New Agey or mystical message from Terrence Malick's film has a counterpart, an opposite, in Lars von Trier's film Melancholia, which is all about a kind of cosmic depression from what I've read.
Yes, it's very interesting. It was almost as if they were trying to create the world's most diametrically opposed double bill.
I think that's what they were doing.
Yes, and with, you know, it really is with two visionary filmmakers of enormous resources and talent making opposite films. And Lars von Trier's film is about two things. One, a huge planet called Melancholia that is racing toward the Earth and is probably going to destroy it.
Planet depression,
which is the equivalent of the creation of the world in the Malick film. And then side by side with it, you're getting the story of a family, in particular two sisters, one played by Kirsten Dunst, who won Best Actress in the festival and is just great in Melancholia, as the depressive, melancholic sister whose smile is so radiant you love her, and then her sadness is so terrible it annihilates the world. And she has an optimistic sister who looks after her. She's played by Charlotte Gainsbourg. So in fact, the film is both a cosmic and psychological portrait of destruction and destructiveness and darkness. And it ends in darkness in the same way that the Malick film deliberately ends in light.
Now, Lars von Trier, who directed Melancholia, is the founder of, or co-founder of Dogma, which is an anti-Hollywood style of filmmaking where the filmmaking has to adhere to rigid rules. And some of his films seem to me more like an essay about filmmaking or a deconstruction of a film than an actual film. So was this involving in the way that some of his films, as far as I'm concerned, are not?
No, I think this, in some ways this may be the most involving film he'd ever made. And you could tell that he thought it was one of his good ones, partly because he acted so badly at the press conference. He became world famous by comparing himself to Hitler and saying idiotic stuff about Nazis. And what happens with him is that he loves being a bad boy so much that when he makes a film that he genuinely likes and thinks is good and the audience might like, he then can't stop himself from acting even worse than he normally acts, which is pretty bad. So in this case, there's a film that he was really proud of, and so naturally he said the most noxious things he'd ever said at the same time he's promoting it.
Well, the things that he said became far more famous than his film, so can we just talk about that for a moment?
Of course.
So I'm sure there's like some backstory I'm missing here and reading about it in the papers. Let me just do a couple of quotes here, which I got from the New York Times. He was asked, or he was talking about the use of Wagner's Tristan and Isolde in the soundtrack of his film, and he described the film as an important work in the German Romantic tradition. A question followed from a journalist about what he had described in a Danish magazine as his interest in the Nazi aesthetic and his German roots. And the backstory to this is his mother on her deathbed told him that her husband was not his real father, and her husband was Jewish, but his real father, it turns out, was German. So Lars von Trier says, I really wanted to be a Jew, and then I found out that I was really a Nazi. And then referring to Hitler, he said, I think I understand the man. He's not what you would call a good guy, but I understand much about him. I sympathize with him a little bit. Hitler did some wrong things, yes, absolutely, but I can see him sitting in his bunker in the end. I'm not for the Second World War, and I'm not against Jews, not even Suzanne Bier. And Suzanne Bier is another filmmaker from Denmark who tried a dogma film once and then gave up on dogma, and her latest film is In a Better World. So tell us what this was like when you were there at the press conference.
I actually didn't see the press conference live because they're so hard to get into, especially a Lars von Trier press conference. I mean, I saw it on the internet. Well, I can tell you what it's like. Everyone goes because he always says provocative things. I mean, one year he, you know, called Roman Polanski a dwarf when Polanski's jury didn't give him the top prize.
Nice.
You know, every time he acts. In this case, what happened was he got a thought that started off as a perfectly reasonable thought, and then got going almost like a someone with Tourette's who can't stop himself from going. Because in fact, I don't think he was really trying to say the most shocking stuff. But somehow, as the audience gets more shocked, he likes doing it more and more. So he eventually pushed on. And I think what he was trying to say in some way is that he can actually understand some of the impulses behind someone like Hitler, rather than actually sympathizing with Hitler. But once he gets going, he can't stop himself. The press corps, which I talked to afterwards, who got in, was simultaneously aghast and, of course, delighted. Because, you know, when someone says stuff like this at Cannes, you know you suddenly get a front page story rather than an arts page story. So there's actually more glamour and glory for the journalists.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Powers, our critic at large, and we're talking about films he saw at the Cannes Film Festival. So the best screenplay went to an Israeli film about father and son Talmudic scholars, and this is a comedy?
It's a comedy. You know, it's a marvelous comedy. And what it's about is the father in the story is an old school scholar of the vintage old kind who spent all of his time looking closely at the texts from the Talmud in different variations. His son grows up to be a Talmudic scholar, but he's more worldly, more fun, knows how to work in the political world better. And the problem is, since they're both working in the same field, they're both jealous of one another for different reasons. And gradually it's about how there's an award that's going to be given to one of them. And they then have to figure out how to deal with one another's success. And what's the correct way to deal with the success of somebody you're supposed to love, but who you also kind of resent. And it's an extremely funny, beautifully observed movie that actually gives you a portrait of the kind of thing you almost never get to see in movies, which is really, really smart people to begin with. Then the second thing you don't get to see is the world of intellectuals in Israel, because most films about Israel that we get to see tend to have to do with war and the Palestinian problem and all the rest. Whereas here, the real core of it is this patriarchal battle, which is almost a Talmudic battle about the Talmud. The question is, what do you do if a loved one is getting an award that you want?
And this movie's called Footnote.
It's called Footnote.
So a film I'm interested in that I've read a little about is called The Artist, and it's about a silent film star. And the actor who stars as the silent film star just won the Best Actor Award at Cannes. His name is Jean Dujardin?
Yes, Jean Dujardin.
So I couldn't tell from reading about it whether it's a silent film about a silent film or whether it's a film about a silent film, but the rest of the film, the body of the film is not silent. So can you explain?
Yes, it is both a silent film shot in the style of an old silent film, in black and white with the timing and rhythm of a silent film, with intertitles, but it's about a silent film star, played by Jean Dujardin. He's sort of a Douglas Fairbanks type, who's a great heroic figure, but the problem is he's a silent film star, kind of like Singing in the Rain, just at the moment where you're going to sound. And so he's having to deal with that issue. So it's about his life doing it, but it's shot with the look, the production style, the acting style, and the comic timing of a classic old silent film.
Does it work?
It works like wonders. I had a very smart friend of mine went in saying, I tried hard to resist it, but it's irresistible. And I do think that's sort of what almost everybody felt, is that everyone thought, oh, this is going to be a gimmick idea or a pastiche idea. And yet it plays like gangbusters. It got the biggest applause of any film at the festival. You know, it got bought by Harvey Weinstein, who will be pushing it for Oscars. And in fact, it's an incredibly well-directed film by this guy named Michael Azanavicius, who's made a couple spoof, James Bond-type spoofs that I've loved, with this guy Jean Dujardin. But it's extremely funny, very clever, totally worked, and it actually, maybe there's a five-minute dip in the film, but it's actually one of the most enjoyable movies of the year.
So the Best Director Award at Cannes went to a Danish filmmaker named Nicholas Winding Refn.
Refn, yes.
Am I saying that right?
Yes.
So this one's very violent, right?
It's very violent. You know, I mean, this is like the big trademark shot of this is when the hero, played by, of all people, Ryan Gosling, in sort of the Steve McQueen, Clint Eastwood role, you know, smashes people's skulls and they crack like an eggshell. Which, just to make your mouth water a little bit about how violent it is. What's interesting about the film is that it's a film that's almost an action film that's almost pure style. If you imagine how you felt when you saw Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction and thought, oh, he's taking something that's old and then refining out a lot of the stuff that was there before and making a sort of a pure, almost abstract version of some of that. Nicholas Winding Refn is maybe Tarantino's Tarantino. He's seen the same exploitation movies, the same Hong Kong movies, and all the rest, and he boils everything down to almost pure style. There's almost no real emotion in it. The idea of emotion almost doesn't make any sense. It's purely kinetic energy, stylized lighting, stylized motion, stylized everything. And, you know, I personally didn't like it very well, but I should say that the younger critics at Cannes really loved it. The audience liked it, and I think it won the director prize because it's purely a pared-down piece of style that, as I say, younger critics liked, perhaps because every generation gets to have somebody who's their exemplar of pared-down, reinventive style. But it wasn't for me, although I think I'm curious to see what happens when it comes out in September, because it will be coming out in September. All the people were predicting that it'll make Ryan Gosling a big star. And I'll be interested to see that because, I mean, really, he didn't seem very tough to me.
What's the weirdest film you saw at Cannes?
The weirdest film I saw at Cannes, and one of the weirdest films I've ever seen, is a film called This Must Be the Place by an Italian director named Paolo Sorrentino. And it stars Sean Penn as a 50-year-old, faded and retired goth rocker living in Ireland with, he looks like, if you ever saw the band The Cure, he looks like the guy Robert Smith from, he wears black leather, his black hair down to his shoulders, he wears lipstick and all the rest. And anyway, when his father dies, he flies back to America and discovers that his father has a small vendetta against a guy who was his guard at Auschwitz. And so, dressed as a 50-year-old goth rocker and talking in a voice like this, Sean Penn, pulling his suitcase behind him in virtually every scene, enters a cross-country road trip to track down a Holocaust criminal. So it's a Holocaust road movie, which at the same time is his coming-of-age story, because the film is about how he comes of age at age 50. And in addition to all of this, it's a comedy. In addition to all of this, there are individual details in it that I can't describe to you that make this film even weirder than that makes it sound. You know, Sean Penn with shoulder-length black hair in black leather and lipstick, working with a Simon Wiesenthal kind of guy to track somebody down in a comedy.
Is it good?
No, it's not good. It's not good at all. But what's remarkable is that I didn't meet a single person who thought it was good, and yet everyone stayed. Because when you're sitting there, your jaw is dropping farther and farther. Because and at every single moment, you think, oh, what could they do that's weirder? Oh, David Byrne is going to come out, and he and his band are going to sing the entire song from which This Must Be the Place comes. And you're like, huh, that's odd. You didn't need to show the whole song. You know, and or that you then go out to the Wild West, and naturally you instantly find a buffalo. It's kind of a crazy European's self-conscious idea of America, where David Byrne and buffaloes are things you see all the time.
You know, a lot of filmmakers want to think of their films as like edgy and risky. One of the filmmakers whose movie was at Cannes risked his life to make the movie that was shown there. And I'm thinking of the Iranian filmmaker whose name I don't know how to pronounce, so I'll let you handle that. But tell us about the risk he took to make this movie.
Yes, his name is Jafar Panahi, and he is probably the person who's been the most interesting Iranian director over the last 10 or 12 years. He got himself in trouble with the government because during the troubled election of a couple of years ago, he was identified as being not just an opposition person, but a threat to national security. Various judges declared that he should go to prison for 6 years and was banned from filmmaking for 20 years. While he appeals that decision, he's living under house arrest, but not allowed to make films. So what he's done is he has had a friend come over, and basically they shoot a film inside his apartment where he is under house arrest. And what he does is he talks to the camera about his situation. You hear his conversations with his lawyers about what the government's going to do to him. He actually at one point tapes out the set of a film he'd been making on the floor of his own room, all the rooms of the place of the film he was making, and begins acting out scenes from the film he was making when he was interrupted and banned from filmmaking. And gradually what happens is you start seeing about his life and how he fits into the political situation of things. And essentially what the big insistent point they keep making is that he's not actually making a film. The film is called This Is Not a Film, because if he actually is making a film, he's violated the rules under which he's living, in which case he could perhaps go to prison for life. So he's making a film, or part of making a film, called This Is Not a Film, which is all about why he can't make a film. And it builds to this amazing sequence where there's a guy outside his door who claims to be collecting trash, but neither he nor we can tell whether he really is the janitor of this building, or in fact he's a secret policeman. And it's a really, really marvelous sequence that really rivets the audience. But what's brave about it is that, unlike most filmmakers who don't take any real risks except maybe of money, Panahi could in fact go to jail for the rest of his life if they decide that This Is Not a Film is a film.
It's part of the reason why he can call it This Is Not a Film, because it was shot on, you know, like an over-the-counter,
yes,
kind of like little video camera, one of those like little fits in one hand video cameras and maybe a cell phone?
Yes, no, I think so. I think it's partly that in literal terms it is not a film. You know, it was shot on a DV camera and on a cell phone and was smuggled out of the country inside a flash drive, put inside a cake, I believe, and taken to Cannes. So on the one hand, it literally is not a film. And then the question is whether or not he directed the film, because part of the law is he's not allowed to direct a film, but he wasn't explicitly banned from being in a film or from writing a film. So therefore, he can be partly in it, but there are funny moments where his directorial habit is so strong, he will tell the guy who's shooting it to cut. And then the guy behind the camera will say, no, you can't say cut, because if you say cut, you're directing a film. And then you're breaking the law.
Well, John, should we end by saying a few words about Daniel Krim, who is the head of Kino Films, who died during the festival at the age of 65 of cancer?
Yes, well, Krim was a man who had done very generous and good things. You know, there was a generation of people who loved cinema in a way that I think younger people never will, because the culture doesn't love it. And he spent his entire life helping people who might otherwise not have their film show anywhere, show in the United States, and taking great old films by Chaplin and Keaton and making sure they were preserved, making sure they were copied, put on DVD, and made available to everybody. So he's actually one of the great heroes of the film business. There are a handful of those people around who don't make much money, but who are doing it purely from love. And when you actually talk to people inside the film world, they are revered figures, because everybody knows they were honorable and decent and made the world better.
Well, John, I want to thank you for talking with us about the Cannes Film Festival. I always look forward to these conversations, and now I have a lot of great films to look forward to seeing. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
John Powers is Fresh Air's critic at large. He writes about film for Vogue and Vogue.com. The Cannes Film Festival wrapped up last weekend. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Simon. I'm Terry Gross.